The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed hikes rates. Markets swing with uncertainty. New orders slip as core prices gain. And Elon Musk is sued by the SEC. All this and much more on episode number 581 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of this and DH Unplugged podcast each and every week, where we talk about business, investments, finance, the news that makes all of this happen, as well as some education. We're going to talk about a lot of things today because the news flow has been very strong. There's a lot going on in terms of what's happening with markets and the Fed. And we've seen some very interesting things with regard to some of the political news flow, which we're going to kind of stay away from because between me and you, I'm over it. I mean, the incredible amount of just dysfunction when it comes to politics in general. I don't care what side of the aisle you're sitting on. It is a disaster zone. And I really don't want to get involved in it. As a matter of fact, while I did spend some time watching the hearings recently in Congress over the Supreme Court nominee, you know, after about, 35, 40 minutes, it was more of an entertainment type of process that I engaged in, I think, than it was more information because It was a circus. It was a show. It was really just a, you know, he said, she said. And what impact really does it have on markets? I really don't think that it does. What impacts it have on our lives? That's a different story, but that's not what we're necessarily here for. We're really talking about the whole aspect of markets. So why don't we talk about some of the things that matter? Why don't we stay attention? By the way, when we pay attention to things like some of the political shenanigans that are going on and we're spending our day watching things that really aren't that important, for those of us that are investors, now all of it encompasses the importance, right? All of it is an integral part of the investment process. However, at the same time, some of it matters and some of it doesn't. How do you discern what matters and what doesn't? Well, that's more difficult. But generally speaking, right now, the political scene in the U.S. is, I think the benchmark is, the baseline is outright craziness. Anything that falls underneath or outside of that, if you can get outside of that, may have some impact on markets, but I think I think that we have been all programmed at this point to understand that there is an incredible amount of uncertainty and geopolitical tensions and just an overall sense that there is no stability, and therefore we've become used to it, immune to it, and maybe even somewhat calloused. And therefore, when it comes to markets and investing, that's not really what is going to matter. Now, when you take it all in its totality, it does have some impact. We have to, when we step back, not one pace, but maybe two paces, or maybe even three paces, and look at it in its totality, and look at trade deals, and look at relationships, that may have something to do with how the markets are going to play out over a longer period of time. But the day-to-day nonsense that we hear, the tweets, the news flow, the accusations, the digs. I think we're just all so, unfortunately, we're so used to it at this point after a couple of years of this going on that markets pretty much say, it doesn't matter. We're going to try to really stay focused. That is something of a lesson. That lesson is that What is important and what always will be important are the underlying fundamentals, sentiment, and I would say overall trend, which kind of is a bit of a subset of sentiment. So keep that in mind. Now, what is important? What did happen that could be considered market moving? That is something we should be paying attention to. And well, I guess clearly the top of that is the Fed. And the Fed increased rates and had a relatively short statement that appeared to take out key comments about this accommodative policy that they've been holding for the last 9-10 years. Now, it was interesting to note that even though they took out this, they struck this one sentence on this short statement that they put out before Fed Chair Powell spoke and did his press conference after the 25 basis points increase. And markets saw this generally somehow as dovish, thinking that, well, it looks to us that while it's taking out accommodative policy, they still are only going to be staying with a very slow and steady process. And therefore, this was expected. And markets initially really didn't blink. Once the number came out, there was an expectation. It was close to 100% probability that there was going to be a rate hike this particular event. And it did play out just that way. And now we have the news out. It wasn't any worse than was expected. And therefore, all right, markets could get back to doing what they do. Investors clicked in, started buying, the algos turned on, high-frequency traders started moving in, and they started to, once again, bring up markets. Now, as Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, started answering questions, and one of the things that he brought up was the elimination of a particular, or maybe an addition, I guess it would be, of a date that they would look to stop raising rates. That also was seen as relatively dovish. So whereas we knew that, well, probably in 2018, there was 2 rate hikes that we're going to see, and maybe about 3 in 2019 is the prediction. There was a bit of an unknown there. How long would it continue after that? And if you just piece it all together and add it up very simply of where we would have to be to get to normalization, it would pretty much be after the third increase in 2019. Therefore, there was some certainty that was developing in this. And the reality was that now all of a sudden people could say, well, if they're talking about really viewing this as a place that they would stop and a normal level is about 3% or so, well, that's not so bad. We're not talking about what we saw back in the 80s with 10, 12, 15% interest rates. We're talking about 3% on the Fed funds rate. Not so bad. And therefore, again, was seen as a bit of a more dovish concept or bullish for the markets in general. Now, at the same time, there's some other questions asked about, you know, where the Fed was, and they seem to get a little bit more hawkish. Bottom line is, it looks like we're going to have one more rate hike for 2018, probably in December, and then possibly for 3 for next year. And markets then turned around, by the way. By the end of the day on the Fed talk, what we have seen so many times is whatever the initial reaction is, it seems to turn around and go the opposite direction by the end of the day. And then we may see a continuation or a reversal of that the following day, and then we get some choppiness after that as this is all being digested. Now, we know that there has been a negative impact, a detriment to emerging markets due to the fact that the Fed has been raising rates and they've been withdrawing liquidity from the markets. U.S. dollar has been going up. This all has been very much a problem for emerging markets and for ex-U.S. It's been very beneficial here because there's a lot of really good economics that are coming out of the U.S. for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of places seeing this domestically and internationally as, you know, if we compare the economics and the outlook for countries around the world, well, the U.S. looks pretty good. And why not put our money there? And that's why we're seeing significant flows into the U.S. But one of the things that's happening also is this yield spread and the curve is just not loosening up at all, and it's becoming a problem for financials. Have you looked recently at the U.S. home construction ETF? This is down about 18% year to date. We're seeing higher costs for materials that clearly was present more so at the beginning of the year. We saw rate increases throughout the year. So that meant that the cost of money was increasing for buyers. So you got a margin squeeze for some of the builders. You're seeing that home sales are kind of slowing. And the top holdings in this U.S. construction ETF are down pretty well. You got D.R. Horton. You got Lennar. You got NVR, Toll. You got Home Depot and Lowe's. But 18% for the year for this particular ETF. So there's some question as to, oh man, this is the beginning of the end. Why? Well, because look at the housing indices. And people are saying, I remember this was the cause of the last crash. I remember that the housing crisis was the epicenter and housing was the canary in the coal mine. And we're starting to see that again. And man, there's been so much building that's gone on. And now all of a sudden that the Fed is raising rates and we're seeing a rollover of the housing environment and, you know, builders are really taking it on the chin. I'm really worried here. But let's for a moment, let's take a breath. It's not the same at all. It's not. By no stretch of the imagination is what's going on right now the same as what we've seen back about 10 years ago because, yes, the housing stocks are taking a beating. But it is at no way at all. At all. I mean, I can't even think of one particular item that makes it a good corollary to what happened back in 2006, 2007, and 2008 plus. Because back then, we had some crazy credit offerings. Yeah, there's some things perking up in the markets right now. We're starting to see some securitization again. But back then, we had securitization upon securitization upon securitization and leverage on top of leverage on top of leverage on the securitization. Don't forget that banks had the ability to leverage like 40 times back then. And a lot of regulations came into play after that, disallowing anything even near that. And yet today we have this slowdown in housing activity. And if you did see the housing numbers of late, both existing, new homes, orders, pendings, there's definitely some weakness, some softness in those numbers. So when we look at this, It's for different reasons. Now, if in fact this turns out to be a much broader based situation where now housing prices come down, which we haven't seen that with the Case-Shiller numbers at all. Last number was a 5.9% increase on a year-over-year basis with the 20-city Case-Shiller home index. That's still in a growth phase. Yes, we're seeing that days on inventory for existing is maybe in some areas rising. We're seeing that there are places that are having problems selling property, particularly at the high end, New York in particular, San Francisco. San Francisco is still selling, but the high end of New York is really seeing some problems. So when we look at this, I think that there's a little bit too much excitement about this whole housing issue that is, you know, coming to play here. Now, it's like anything else. When you have higher costs and input costs and you have an elongated period of time for the build process, so you're not basically getting in your materials today, manufacturing it, and selling it tomorrow. The housing companies are selling a house, getting their materials, and it may take a year or so to build it. And those materials may not come immediately. They may start buying them now, but you know, still, there may be some margin squeezes due to the fact that how high can you raise the price of a house in the face of increasing input costs when it comes to both labor and, of course, for materials? So that's part of the reason why that's showing some problems. Again, it's not necessarily the fact that there is a meltdown of the housing and the residential housing area due to the fact that there's some real wonky investments that were being made that were no way going to hold up once rates either moved up or once there was a crack in the underlying or once the kind of like once the chairs stopped and when the music stopped, the musical chairs. So in terms of what's going on now with regard to the Fed raising rates, what's going on with the housing situation and housing stocks, we have to then take a step back and look at where markets are playing out right now. There's been an incredible amount of continuing rotation into various sectors. We're seeing that certain sectors are doing really well, and then all of a sudden they lay off, and then all of a sudden another sector comes up. And this rotation has been ever present, and indices themselves have been holding up very well, near all-time highs, generally speaking, for the U.S. Now, again, we're seeing a lot of problems in terms of the areas around the world, ex-U.S., but this is due to the fact that I think that, you know, this U.S. dollar situation is causing a lot of those problems. Will that reverse? Possibly. Into the midterm elections, I think they're going to do everything they can to push in every single possible economic opportunity into, you know, try to press it real hard, whether it's this, tax cuts 2.0, which is going to extend permanently the personal income tax cuts that were put in, probably not going to play. But there's going to be a continuation of the idea that the U.S. is still the strongest house. And algos seem locked into the idea that when we have a higher U.S. dollar, it's really good for markets. In other words, if you kind of look at the intraday movement of the U.S. dollar and the markets, you wonder whether or not actually money is coming into play from foreign assets, converting it to dollars and buying equities, or if the algos are playing games as a signal in order to trigger more algo buying, because almost on every occasion that we've seen the market drop recently, there's been a concurrent rise in the dollar, particularly against the yen. And recently, the entire meltdown of the Italian financial complex due to the fact of their inability to form a good budget. The euro has been coming down precipitously over the last several days. The yen has been moving up, all favoring the dollar. And again, that favor is because we are stronger here. We don't have those budget problems necessarily. We have a deficit that's growing out of control. But that is seemingly triggering a movement into U.S. positioning. But also, I think there's a lot more to say about what's going on with markets in terms of quarter and year-end positioning. So we have month-end, quarter-end that just happened, and year-end positioning. And as we talked about, I think it was last week, with seasonality trends, the next few months have a tendency to move higher into the year-end. It's just on average, there is a higher probability that markets and buyers will step up into the end of the year for all sorts of reasons. But it doesn't matter the reasons. I mean, we can list that, well, there's a chase for returns, you know, there's a known season. It doesn't matter. The fact is that we do know that there is a seasonality trend that really does benefit the bullish argument for markets. Plus, as most headwinds, especially the negative headwinds that we've seen, I guess headwinds are always negative, are being ignored. And we spoke about this recently with the whole idea of the narratives in play right now. It will take some serious changes to really push investors to change their habits. And the response that we see, that Pavlovian response of buy on the bell at 9:30 in the morning, regardless of what's going on, regardless if we see that, you know, spending is lower or durable goods is really failing, and we've seen that exports are lower than expected, or GDP comes in at a lower, whatever happens, 9:30 in the morning, the machines turn on, and whether it's the buybacks, whether it's just sentiment, whether it's just the desire that any dip at all, even a slight dip of 5 points or 10 points on the S&P 500, futures are enough to bring people into the market. So what do we have? When we look at all this, we talked about this last week. We have a good amount of positive economic tailwinds, employment, GDP. Yeah, there's a few areas that may be concerning, but also we have to agree that they may be transient. Some of those areas that are causing us to question what's happening with U.S. economics may be just simply transient. And markets are looking for the good news and ignoring the most of the bad. And coming into seasonality, it's a good time for markets. So I guess, you know, in a way, you have to say, well, what could go wrong? What? I mean, what? And that sometimes people also take as a signal of, you know, there is something possibly pending that is unknown out there that may be a catalyst for causing some problems. But really, if you're not of the negative side of things and you have negative sentiment as a core of how you think, you really got to believe that there is a good bullish argument here into the end of the year, especially. Now, again, that may not be every day and every week, but generally speaking, there is. I mean, even though we had seen that September is one of the worst months in history, when you look at seasonality in general for equity markets in the U.S., that didn't really stop anybody from buying away. So I think we need to be on our toes. We need to be proactively looking for, okay, what could go wrong here and where are the holes in my thesis here? When I say my, I mean ours, yours. I mean, just look at Tesla. Tesla is a really, it's almost the poster child of what is the market sentiment today and what is going on. Because when we look at Tesla, we see that, well, we know they're burning through cash. We know they're having a hard time with orders recently. We know that the CEO, Elon Musk, has gone off the rails on many occasions, from calling that guy in Asia pedo to bringing up, you know, their profitability numbers, from the funding secured tweet to shutting down questions from analysts that are well-respected in the conference calls and calling it boring, moving on, and from all the other things that have gone on. We know something's not quite right there. Meanwhile, every time the stock seems to drop, even in the face of an SEC inquiry, buyers come right back in, holding it near the $300 level. That's amazing, because any other company that is losing money as fast as they are, that are losing their top management as quickly as we've seen these happen over the last several weeks, and with a CEO that looks, well, something's not quite right in terms of his attitude, you would think that they would really take this down. Now, fast forward, and we did see this week that the SEC is now coming after Elon Musk himself for fraud over the funding secured tweet that he laid out, and is looking potentially for his banishing him from being CEO or holding another management position at the company. That's a problem. Because if we believe that there is a significant amount of benefit that's being put to the CEO, in other words, a lot is riding on how well the CEO does and how well there is the opportunity for the company to do well under his leadership, and put everything aside, the losses aside, put all that aside, then the fact of the matter is that there may be something to be said about if, in fact, if he is banned from being the CEO and he's taken out of a leadership position for the company, what is left for the stock? That's something you need to ask yourself and come up with a reasonable story on, because if the story has been based on just that, then if you take that away and you look at the rest of it, peel back the banana and you find a rotten core, what do you do? Something to think about. Now, last week we talked about this study that we were doing, and I think this is really interesting because this study that we're working on with regard to the benefits of active versus passive management. Now, what does that mean? You know that over the last, let's say 5 to 7 years, There's been a strong argument that I think has been implanted or brainwashed into all of our psyches that the use of passive investments or index ETFs for equities has been very beneficial because you got, what do you have? You have low costs. You have the thought that, well, what's the point of trying to beat an index? Why not just be the index? And for the most part, well, we've been in agreement with that. It makes sense. Because it makes sense that if, in fact, we're trying to gain the returns and risk profile that's associated with a particular index or area of the market, why not just do that? Why vary? If we're looking for a large cap exposure or you are looking to have an S&P 500 index return, why go to a fund that may have higher expenses, a little bit higher risk in order to get the returns, and all they're trying to do is benchmark to the S&P 500? Just go buy the SPY. Now, while we're in agreement with that, we've also been rather firm on the idea that inefficient markets could be problematic for indexing or passive investing. So let's talk about that for a second. What exactly is an inefficient market? So we look at things like emerging markets, for example, some non-US equity markets, and what you have that's going on there that makes them less efficient or inefficient to a degree is currency. You have currency issues. You have political issues. The governments may be, let's just say, not as cooperative to capital markets as some other areas, some other countries. You have non-conforming accounting that may not be in line with what we see for things like general accepted accounting principles, GAAP, or may have a looser set of standards. You have market regulation that also may be subpar. And things like language barriers. So all these things, when you put them all together, could create a significant amount of inefficiencies inside of a particular market. That makes sense? As opposed to, we know what the standard accounting processes are here in the United States. We know what the regulatory backbone is in terms of markets, oversight. We know the currency, of course. We know the language. It's a lot easier and more efficient on how they're building these indices. You also have the idea that with this inefficiency, it would probably be better to look for an active manager in those areas that will have oversight of the portfolio, local knowledge, understanding of the politics, language, currencies. That all kind of flows pretty well. I don't think that a lot of people could really argue with that point. Now, over the years, we've seen, well, there's been a good benefit for all this concept within the equity space. In other words, use ETFs for the equity space in the areas that there are efficient markets. Go passive, index for that matter. Very inexpensive, very much aligned with your particular area that you're trying to emulate within a portfolio that is diversified. Don't try to beat the averages. Make it simple. And that's really the heart and the crux of this. And on the other hand, you want to use mutual funds with the best management teams, long-term track records, good statistical returns and risk-related and risk-adjusted performance, and low costs for inefficient markets. So play the efficient markets with a passive strategy. Play the inefficient markets with an active strategy. Now, we also did this for fixed income areas, the concept. But the game's a little bit different there. Clearly, there's a lot more to be looked at. As crazy as that may sound, a lot of people think, well, fixed income, that's easy, buy bonds. Okay, easy peasy. There's a lot more that goes into that, though. Now, what we wanted to do was refresh a study that we did some time ago to see exactly what areas within the fixed income space would be better on a passive versus an active basis. And again, remember, a good amount of, I guess the best word is brainwashing has been done when it comes to active versus passive over the last several years. And it's played out well because while it's been pummeled into our heads that you want to be cheap and index and you want to go passive, you want to look at the indexes as best as possible to emulate. And it's been playing out really well when it comes to the equity markets. Why bother getting in the trenches with individual securities or in, you know, an active situation where you could have a particular stock that goes haywire on you or try to beat something that's, in a sense, unbeatable. And I think that many believe that because the major indices within the U.S. have been really better suited to invest in through index-based ETFs and passive styles that are inexpensive, that somehow this has transposed itself and oozed into the idea that, well, the same is probably good for fixed income. Passive is always better. Cheap and low costs are always better. But here's something I'm going to tell you. Not really. Not all the time. Sometimes you gotta believe that you get what you pay for sometimes. And when it comes to fixed income, it seems that from what we're seeing, we're putting the finishing touches on this right now and really just making sure all the numbers line up and everything that we're looking at does confirm and there's no irregularities in our calculations. But there are too many examples to mention what may be the appropriate way to invest in terms of active management, even with higher fees that will actually get you better returns when it comes to the fixed income space. Now, you may be listening saying, well, I don't invest in fixed income. I'm talking to you if you have a traditional or a more traditional diversified portfolio, maybe a 401k plan, maybe you have an asset allocation program, that you have some component of that that has some fixed income. And I want you to approach this with an open mind. I want you to clear all the brainwashing that's gone on, all the things that you've seen from equity investing and your ideas and the confirmations that you've had, the biases that you may have developed and what you see in the media. Let's just clear all that. Clear the decks. Let's just get some clean space out there. A whiteboard with nothing on it. And talk about some of the results that we've seen. So here's an example that we developed in terms of how we are actually looking at this. So we looked at some search criteria. We looked at 75% of the top performing funds versus ETFs that are indexed, again, inside of various sectors of the fixed income space. For example, the short duration sector. Now, what would you think that would be, right? You have a short-term bonds. How hard is it to invest in short-term bonds and why bother paying up for it? Why should I use active management? It would seem that's a pretty efficient market. You know, you have bonds of 0 to 5 years, 6 years, definitely under 7 years, but your duration's maybe 2, 2.5. But you have a short-term bond portfolio. Again, nothing very fancy. Seems like a pretty liquid space with good characteristics for an index approach. I got to tell you, when you look at that from what it is. However, what was really interesting here is that the average fund on a rolling 3-year basis during our look back period had netted investors significantly more than the return of an index fund or an ETF, net of all fees. Let me just say that again. When we looked at the top 75%, so we didn't use the bottom funds in this whole list because we're thinking that even if we threw a dart, we'd probably be able to pick one of the top 75% of all funds within this universe of mutual funds by just some selection process of looking at Sharpe ratios, looking at alpha, looking at expense fees, management, tenure, long-term performance. We figured we'd be able to pick that. But even if we weren't able to do it really well, 75% of the top performing funds should be able to give us enough of an area that we would find the right fund to choose from versus an ETF or a passive index. Now, of course, this study looks even better if we say, let's just look at the top 25%, top 10%. But we want to take a wide range of possibilities and not say that we were able to really pick and choose what is going to be a better fund over the long haul than another. So we took a pretty wide range of funds from a performance standpoint over the historical period that we looked at, used a rolling period return, which we think is a much more appropriate way to look at this, because we don't know exactly year to year or month to month what's happening. So we want to look at these rolling returns. And we came back with a very, not just 0.1% better. And on a short duration or a short-term bond fund, you know, we're talking about returns on an annual basis that may be 3 to 5%, maybe. And we're talking about a 25% better net return. Now, think about that. That's a big margin of improvement. So we sat back and said, well, why is that? Why are we seeing that? And here's a few things that we came up with. It may be that the better performance from this particular fund, or maybe even expand it out into the fixed income universe, is because the manager's ability and better ability to pick and choose what they're investing in. Whereas an index fund really will just go out, or an ETF will just go out and buy what components make up that index. That's really all they care about, is just emulating that index. An active fund can actually pick and choose what goes into their fund against their benchmark. Liquidity and liquidity functions of the fund itself may be helpful. In times of stress in markets, they may be able to go out and buy up some of the positions that are being sold heavily by index funds and investors and ETFs that have to just liquidate and get that out of their portfolio because they have withdrawals that are coming in. And again, they're just going to sell it at any price they have, whereas some of these funds may be able to pick up some of those at a better price. Also, the manager's ability to spot value. There's a different level of scrutiny that's going into the active management buying of fixed income securities for this particular sector than there is for the index fund, for the most part. There's also the ability for active managers to hold through sell-offs and pick up bargains and manage their flows in and out of the fund. In other words, manage the amount and what they're going to sell when they have those withdrawal requests that come in, when they have the selling pressure that really comes up significantly. And what happens there is that now those are just a few factors that have made up not only for the higher cost of being inside of that active mutual fund, but the significant outperformance of it. Because when you really look at it, the fixed income market in general is not as efficient as, let's say, the large cap equity markets of the US. It's just not. A lot more that goes into the pricing of a bond, and every little bit that can be picked off from a benefit by the active managers in the buying and selling process really leads to a much better result, we have found, for investors in our portfolios. And we use this concept in both the investology offering that we have and the global allocations, because we really spend a lot of time looking at what funds will make up the sectors that we believe are the right and proper allocations dependent on risk and time horizon. But when you look at that and then you start saying, okay, we have targeted through our process that a 5% or 10% position should be in low duration or short-term bonds, then we have to go out and find what investment will underlie that particular sector. So not only do we have the process of picking how much of a portfolio should be in a particular sector that is represented and appropriate for any particular client's level of risk and time horizon and match that up, but then we have to come up with, okay, how do we invest in that? And now that we're going out and trying to look for the best investment, net of all fees, risk-adjusted performance, and all the other things, you know, the 10 or 15 other characteristics that make up an appropriate investment within that sector, we have to think about the idea that, well, are we going to index this or are we going to go for an active manager? So that's just one piece of it, but I found that really interesting. We'll have a full detail and summary of the findings of this report out soon. It will be in our next quarterly economic commentary and overview. So if you want to get on this list to see how this all plays out, we'll probably have just a good amount of the summarization of our findings on the fixed income space. You can make sure that you're on the mailing list. And all you have to do is go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There should be a pop-up that comes into view when you first log in or first go to the site. Just make sure to put your name and email in there, and we'll send you a copy of this. So just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and go on the mailing list. Well, actually, I'll have a little quick form you can fill out too, just to get on the mailing list if you want to do it, on the show notes for this episode 581. So to finish up on a topic that we've been, I feel like I've been really pounding this hard, and I think that it really bears some final discussion here in this episode, and it's this whole idea of this pull forward effect. It's an item that we've been discussing for some time, and I wanted to make sure that you're on the lookout for this. Just somewhere in the corner of your eye, just pay attention, because if this does play out like it could, again, this is a theory at this point. We don't really know this is actually totally occurring because we've only seen the first part of it. We've cracked the door open and we're seeing a little bit of a peek and we're envisioning what it could be on the other side. But we're not there yet, and we don't know if it's going to play out exactly as this. But it's something you really need to look at seriously. And the potential for manufacturing and sales exports to get a major kick, a major increase and benefit from the concern that there's prices going higher is something really to pay attention to. We've been going on and on again for this for months now. And it may go on for a little bit longer because we've had this rolling implementation of tariffs, and therefore not all of them were put into place. So we may see that there is going to be a significant amount of manufacturing and buying and a big push on exports as the implementation went on. So here's the question. Wouldn't you buy something that you use or need on a regular basis ahead of the idea that you know and a known price increase is going to come in the future? If you knew that, I don't know, tissues that you use on a regular basis are going to go up by 400% in 2 months, wouldn't you stock up a little bit on that? Or spaghetti? Or ketchup? Or a car? Or anything that you use on a regular basis and that you need? And think about that on a personal basis, but also think about that on a corporate basis. Companies that utilize goods or materials to manufacture their product for sale, if they know that that product, whether it's the pre-finished or the finished goods, are going up in value and they need to make sure they lock in the price today, don't you think they're going to stock up pretty heartily? They're going to go out and buy everything they can and make sure they have what they need in order to lock in that opportunity to keep their margins. And our thought is it's going to take some time, maybe months, for this condition to play out. In other words, the excessive buildup of inventories ahead of the tariff implementations will lead to the potential for a precipitous drop in economic activity on the other side. And we may be seeing some of this now. We saw a slowdown in durable goods orders this month. But still, it's not enough. I don't think it's enough really to confirm. And it's not in the right time frame either. I'll be kind of surprised if this does all of a sudden just drop off right here. But it's not within the time frame that we would expect. We'd expect that orders and manufacturing reports and exports and retail spending over the next coming months, particularly I would say towards the end of the year and into the beginning of the year, if in fact we do see that there is a drop off at that point, then you know something's happening. Now, at the same time, markets are a forward discounting mechanism, and maybe markets would be ahead of this. So look at this together. See if certain areas of the markets will see this before we see this. But we know that GDP now is what, 4.2% in the last quarter. So let's watch what's going to be coming up in the coming quarters, in the next two quarters in particular. The time that we're predicting would show that this condition would be true if we see a slowdown towards the end of the year into the first quarter of 2019. So I'm going to leave that there. Unless I see further confirmation of this, I'm going to bring this back to you. In other words, we're going to watch all these numbers, watch the exports. We're going to watch manufacturing, inventory levels, retail sales over the next few months. And in particular, we're going to really weight that view towards the end of the year and into the first quarter. If in fact we start to see that, we're going to blow the horn pretty loud that we need to be aware that GDP may be coming down very strong, definitely off of these 4.2 numbers above 4%, predicting that you're going to see closer to back towards maybe 2% starting the first quarter of 2019. Now, if you do see 2%, 2.2%, whatever the number is, into first quarter 19, I guarantee you what you're going to start to hear from all the places out there that love to do this is say, well, the first quarter is usually a weak quarter. You know, that was an argument that we had when GDP was calculated a particular way, and it kind of led the first quarter to be this weird calculation, and the second quarter made up for it. And when you put it all back together, it averaged out very nicely. They fixed that about a year ago, maybe it was a year and a half ago. So I'm not really buying that. Just keep an eye on it. Let's not be swayed by all the nonsense that we hear from the media and the narratives that are out there. So, summarizing what we talked about today, we know the Fed increased rates. Elon Musk is being sued. Financial stocks are not doing well, and the home bills are really taking being cracked pretty well. That does not necessarily mean that it's a canary in the coal mine, nor is it particularly anything more than a particular sector that's being hit by some of these tightening conditions and market forces. It doesn't mean it's going to lead to a crash, because that was a much different situation. Okay. We talked about the active versus passive and the discussion that you need to be thinking a little bit outside the box and clear the slate and make a whiteboard approach to how you're going to invest for a diversified portfolio. And particularly, don't only focus on fees. Sometimes you get what you pay for, sometimes you don't. But realize that you have to be open-minded when it comes to inefficient markets and how to invest there. And finally, the pull-forward effect. So that's going to wrap it up for this week. I want to thank you for joining me. Any questions you have, go over to the Ask Andrew section of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There you can also find information on the managed growth strategy, TDI managed growth strategy, which are active, long, short, hedge style of investing. Also, you can find information on Investology, which is our global diversified allocation, which has a $10,000 minimum, sort of a hybrid robo, where we believe it's advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced investing, and also the global allocation. So all that's right there for you. Thanks so much for your emails. I love them, your comments, and I will see you next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.